Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in recent years, we've all become more familiar than we want to be with the concept of fake news and alternative facts. The lines between fact and fiction in the news and in public discourse have become more blurred. Once in college about 50 years ago, I had a t-shirt made up with the statement, "I'll see it when I believe it." So I thought that was a clever and ironic twist on a cliche, you know, regular college boy, wise guy thing to do. But it's actually becoming more and more the case. People are increasingly coming to accept as fact only what they believe, not what's clearly evident in front of them. And part of what's driving this is not just deliberate propaganda, but also technology. Having your face photoshopped onto another body in some embarrassing pose or situation is becoming one of the occupational hazards of being a celebrity, or increasingly just being a public person at all. This kind of thing used to require specialized expertise and cost thousands of dollars, but now it's becoming just another off-the-shelf app. The personal avatar creator called Avatoon, which I had not heard of until I was looking around on this, and another one called FaceIn, which provides 3D animations, are a couple of examples. So we're talking here about a new media technology called deepfakes. One word, deepfakes. This is what our show today is about. My guest is Sam Gregory. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Court.
Thanks for being on with us. Sam is a program director at Witness, an organization that helps people around the world use video and technology to protect and defend human rights. Sam's current work focuses on the threats and opportunities as emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence intersect with disinformation and media manipulation and also the rise of authoritarianism. So he's on the Technology Advisory Board of the International Criminal Court and is a go-to expert on panels and studies dealing with AI and the media. From 2010 to 2018, I believe, he taught the first graduate-level course at Harvard on harnessing the power of new visual and participatory technologies for human rights change. So first, Sam, before we get into our topic of deep fakes, why don't you tell us a little more about what Witness does?
Thanks, Court. So Witness, we're a global human rights network. We were founded actually 30 years ago this year after an incident in the U.S., actually, the Rodney King incident, where someone with a video camera recorded the brutal beating of a black man in Los Angeles, Rodney King, and set off really, you know, a firestorm of events after that, including the use of that video in the trial. And the founders of Witness identified this opportunity then of, well, what's it going to mean when people have cameras in their hands and what are they going to film and how will this be useful for human rights activism? And so to speak, fast forward 30 years later, and what we do is we work with people around the world, a mix of ordinary people, human rights activists, lawyers who take out usually their cell phones to document what's happening. For example, what's happening in Ukraine now, what happened in Syria, what happens when you have police violence in many different countries. So that's the center of our work, is how do you help people to film the truth in ways that are ethical and meaningful and could lead to accountability. What that's also meant over the past decade, at least, is exactly what you're describing is, you know, we deal more and more with people falsifying videos and images, trying to pass off videos from one place as from another, you know, saying a video of a tank in, you know, in one country as a tank in another country, or a missile strike in another country. And so we've had to grapple with the advent of what we call shallow fakes, which is just easy ways people manipulate videos, and of course, increasingly deep fakes. And that's led us into this work of, you have to help the ordinary person who takes out their cell phone camera, but you've also got to think ahead about the technologies at play. You've got to think ahead about technologies like deepfakes and make sure that they, you know, don't compromise this fundamental ability to show the truth.
Wow, Rodney King. I mean, that really was the very beginning of this. You're right. I mean, everybody old enough to remember it remembers that video taken from some distance away. And you know, I was thinking too about the satirist and novelist and journalist Tom Wolfe, who died a couple of years back. And in one of his books a while back, he talked about people in the future being vidheads, he called them, which was at the time when video cameras were just emerging. I guess it was probably the mid 80s or something. And most people didn't even have a VCR type video camera yet. But that was prescient, as a lot of his things were, because now we're all vid heads in the sense that everybody has a video camera and a high-quality camera in their pocket, and they whip it out to take a picture of anything from, you know, the most trivial thing to something that's of historic significance, as you were saying. So, well, you know, most deepfake videos, as I mentioned at the beginning, so far have been malicious and intended to defame and intimidate people, most often women. In fact, well over, I was looking into this a little bit, well over 90% of deepfake videos involve faces of women swapped onto pornographic scenes. That's kind of surprising that it would be, you know, that high a percentage of it is that. But As I said, usually they're celebrities and they're activists of some kind. And in December 2020, a fraud detection firm called Sensity found, they said, a little over 85,000 deep fake videos circulating online. And they saw that that number had been doubling roughly every 6 months. So by now, there are probably hundreds of thousands of them out there at that rate of increase. But these are basically malicious pranks that hurt individuals. And the danger is that they could start to be used in politics, you know, which is kind of something you were alluding to a minute ago. For example, making political and government figures appear to say things they never said. So what do you think about that prospect more broadly?
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing I'd say is I don't want to minimize the impact of these non-consensual sexual images, which is, as you said, are really the way in which the deepfakes are being used maliciously most often right now. So, you know, someone will find they've been sent an image that appears to show them, you know, in a pornographic movie or appears to show them naked. And, you know, the horrifying element of that is it's easy to do that, or relatively easy to do that, because you can access the tools to do that on, you know, if you look around on the web, and they're very easy to do. And I think they're important to pay attention to because they're directly targeting women, and they have so many corollary effects as well. So even if we're starting to think about politics and the public sphere, we know one of the reasons that women don't, you know, move into politics or are driven out of the public space is often because they face, you know, attacks online and in public spaces. And these non-consensual sexual images are just another way to pile on. So I think we have to look at it as kind of an intersection question. So they're not separate, right? The power to be able to make a nude image of someone without their consent is directly tied to the ability to target them and push them out of being in politics, being in the public sphere, and particularly, as you say, applies to women. So we've already got that problem that is already growing and, as you said, really starting to scale up globally. You know, I think there is a growing prospect for how these will be used in politics more broadly, right? Which is to say that, you know, the motto we have at Witness is prepare, don't panic. And we've said that a lot over the last few years, because what we've seen is that there's a lot of rhetoric around deepfakes. There's a lot of rhetoric about their use in deceiving people in politics. And that rhetoric is in some senses part of the problem. Right, because the rhetoric starts to raise exactly that issue that you raised in your intro, right? Which is, you know, if you start to undermine people's ability to believe what they see, that can also be used as a weapon, right? You can use that claim that you can't believe what you see, that ability to blame deepfakes for the fakery around us as another way to discredit truth. So, you know, We've said prepare, don't panic, because so far we've not seen widespread use of deepfakes in broader political spheres. So we're not seeing, you know, deepfakes taking place in, say, you know, the 2020 elections in the US. We've not seen them in, you know, recent elections that have taken place in other major democracies globally. So it's one thing that people should know is it's not that, like, you know, the majority of, you know, deceptive videos out there in, say, any recent election have been deepfakes. They've, in fact, you know, there have been many deceptive videos in recent political campaigns, but typically they're what we at Witness call shallow fakes. That means that someone, you know, for example, took a video from one place, you know, and they claimed it was from another place. They took a video of some action and then they miscontextualized it. They said it showed something else, or they did some simple edit. And so the biggest threat in politics right now are not deepfakes, they're these, you know, so-called shallow fakes.
Yeah, or just taking, you know, a phrase out of context and putting together three or four of them and making them appear to say something they didn't say. So really, you know, I think the thing is, the worry, I guess, is that we're just at the beginning of this. Like anything that's negative or harmful or dangerous, when you're at the beginning of it, it doesn't seem that dangerous. But for example, have we seen this used in the war in Ukraine at all?
So we've seen a couple of usages in the war in Ukraine. And I think you're describing it exactly right, Cole. We're right at the beginning of this. And I think it's really important to sort of place it in perspective as a threat, and also say, what can we do early to avert, you know, some of the nightmare scenarios that could come to pass? So the war in Ukraine is interesting. You know, we've Witness is doing a lot of work supporting people there who are documenting the truth on the ground, right? So we've been working with groups who've been, you know, documenting missile strikes and the atrocities by the Russian soldiers who've invaded the country. And we've seen a lot of those shallow fakes I described, you know, where someone has claimed a video is from one place and it's from another. And some of these false flag operations, which are where someone, you know, stages an event in order to imply that something happened that it didn't. Hmm. And we've seen one very notable case of a deepfake. And I think it's a really interesting case of a deepfake because it tells us both a lot and a little about the future in politics and globally. So the main deepfake we've seen in the Ukraine context was a video that was released in a hack of a Ukrainian news site. It was a video that appeared to show the Ukrainian president, President Zelensky, essentially surrendering, right? And so this video appeared online. Now, it was a video that was not a terribly well-made deepfake, right? So you could see that the body really didn't look like President Zelensky. The voice sounded a little off. There was a little bit of glitching around his forehead. And in addition to that, the Ukrainian government had in fact warned its population that this deepfake was coming. They'd actually sent out Facebook warnings saying, we think there's going to be a deepfake of President Zelensky, this photorealistic video that will show him surrendering, and don't believe it when it comes out. And so, of course, they told their publics this, sort of what we might call pre-bunking, you know, like debunking, but beforehand. And then, of course, President Zelensky, who has a massive social media following, turned up online and said, hey, that's not me. And so it was not a very effective deepfake. But I think it could give us a bit of a false sense of security around this as a deepfake, because it was almost the ideal scenario for how we'd handle a deepfake. So as I said, you had this kind of warning beforehand of this very specific deepfake that was coming. You had the deepfake come out and it was not very good. You had the person in the deepfake able to basically speak with credibility and say, that's not me. And then it turned out that, of course, the platforms where it was shared, like Facebook, this was a slam dunk for them to remove it, right? No issues deciding whether this was fake or not. They took it down. And most of those characteristics won't be there in the future, right? Like, we're going to get many much more hazy cases, right, where it's a little less clear, was that a real deepfake or not? And, you know, we've been involved in some of those cases globally where it's a lot harder to work out whether it is or it isn't a deepfake, and you see the confusion that sets in. I think that's one of the things we've got to think about in these cases, is that in fact, oftentimes it's the kind of the gray area. It's the ability to not quite know and to cast doubt that becomes really important. The other interesting thing in the Ukraine case was there was actually another video that came out actually a couple of weeks before. And it was a video that showed President Putin of Russia also doing something very similar. So the Zelensky video, he's kind of standing at his podium that folks may have seen. And, you know, if you've ever watched a broadcast of him doing a speech, the Putin one is from the table where he does his kind of speeches to the Russian public. And in this one, Putin also says, you know, we've decided we've achieved our objectives. We're stopping now. And this video came out a couple of weeks before the Zelensky video and kind of was a joke, right? It was like a bit of parody or satire. And we see a lot of deepfake satire out there for political purposes, right? Making fun of politicians, right? That's the primary political use of deepfakes, is for satire. And so this video comes out a few weeks ago, people watch it online. And what was super interesting was when the Zelensky deepfake comes out, which was almost certainly an attempt to deceive people, right? Disinformation. Mm-hmm. The Putin deepfake surfaces again, and people can't work out if it's satire or disinformation. People start to think it's actually another attempt to deceive people, right? Another attempt to kind of mess with people and imply that Putin has surrendered. And the reason I mention that is, like, because deepfakes are these photorealistic videos, right? Like, you have to really understand the context sometimes to know whether they're a joke or whether they're serious, right? And so the Putin video was a joke, but when it got recirculated, people took it seriously.
Yeah, you sent me a link ahead of time to the Zelensky deepfake that you're talking about, and it was pretty clear within a few seconds that it was fake. For one thing, his body was totally rigid and not moving. Mm-hmm. His head was moving a little bit, but mainly the mouth was moving. So, you know, it almost looked like, you know, you could see it was kind of a Photoshop looking thing in a sense, although it wasn't Photoshop, of course. But I could also see that somebody who was very, gullible and kind of hoping to believe that message could believe it, you know, and as somebody who's unsophisticated, it was primitive, but a person with a primitive sense of seeing through things could be fooled by it. And again, that's the problem, is that these things will become less and less primitive and more sophisticated over time. And, you know, I could see that it could become a war of deep fakes where the real message is just mixed in with the deep fakes as just another piece of video information. I mean, one of the many things that's been so impressive, and I suspect it has been to you too, about the Ukraine situation and the Ukrainians, is that during this whole thing, they've been so sophisticated with social media and with using technology, even while their infrastructure is being demolished, to manage to communicate so well among themselves. Well, you know, your house is falling down around you, but you still know what's going on. I don't know if that would happen in this country. I've been very impressed with it, but
Yeah, no, I think that's part of the context. As I say, that's why you know, they've done pretty well in dealing with misinformation and disinformation more broadly. And they did pretty well with what, as you say, was not a very good deepfake, right? You know, it's a deepfake where if you really wanted to believe it, you probably, you know, might believe it. But if you look at it with a skeptical eye, you know, it becomes obvious almost immediately that it's faked.
So let's like project it a little further forward to where deepfakes do become much more convincing, even to a sophisticated eye. Some of it's obvious, but I mean, just talk for a minute about what some of the potential ramifications for diplomacy could be if world leaders are trying to deal with each other and they don't know if what they're looking at is faked or not, you know, unless they're just face to face, which today people aren't so much.
Yeah. So one thing that's worth mentioning is these technologies are getting better, right? So this is, you know, a pretty critical element of understanding why we should prepare, but not panic. We should prepare because what we've seen over the last few years is a progressive improvement in the ability to create fake videos and audio and photos, and to do it with less and less of what we call sort of the training data, right? And to train these models, the artificial intelligence models, to do it in a way that doesn't require you to do it in a very personalized way, right? And so all these trends mean that it's getting easier and easier to create a variety of ways to create these videos and audio of people saying and doing things they never did. And so I think this has very significant ramifications in the long run for how we trust and verify the images and videos we see, including live streams, right? In fact, you know, we're starting to see tools that make it easier to falsify someone within a Zoom live stream, right? Mm. And so, you know, we've moved into this world where we talk in video chat rooms, right? And those are potentially vulnerable to these types of tools and an imposter there, right? And we've seen people not being imposters with deepfakes, although it was claimed at the time, but just, you know, using someone who looks like someone and deceiving, you know, parliamentarians in the Netherlands into thinking they're talking with, you know, a dissident in Russia, right? So we see already these scenarios where kind of many of the sort of means of communication we use now are vulnerable to being abused. And when you pair that with the ways in which deepfake technology is improving, you start to see all these questions about how we prepare better to detect and analyze and spot when a deepfake is being used. And you also see a sort of second pattern of threats, which is about the ability to claim something is faked when it isn't. It's called the liar's dividend. And the liar's dividend is this idea that someone who is trying to cover up something, for example, a video that shows them involved in corruption or sexual misconduct or a crime, can just say, well, that video was faked, and put the pressure on the viewers and everyone else to prove it's real. And it's been really interesting the last few years. As I said earlier, when you're asking about, like, you know, what have we seen so far? We haven't seen many deepfakes used in politics and in diplomacy. We've seen these satirical deepfakes like the Putin deepfake I mentioned. What we have seen is an increasing prevalence of this liar's dividend. And so, you know, when I saw the Zelensky video in Ukraine, actually, the video that jumped to mind in my mind was a video that at Witness we grappled with from the country Myanmar in Southeast Asia, that folks may also know as Burma, right? So this is a country that had a military coup in February last year, in which, you know, the democratically elected government was forced out by the military. And just shortly after the coup, the military released a video that showed a very prominent politician confessing to corruption involving the sort of de facto prime minister of Myanmar, someone folks may know as the Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, right? So it's a very important video in which he accuses her of corruption. And what was interesting is this video came out, was released by the military, circulated online. And what happened was people said they looked at it and the man is sitting in a room. He's looking, probably reading off maybe a teleprompter, off a piece of paper. His voice sounds very unnatural. His lips seem to glitch a little bit. They don't seem like they quite match up. And people instantly said, look, we think this has got to be a deepfake, right? They looked at it and they were like, maybe this is a deepfake. And what was challenging was that it's very hard for the average person to analyze, to work out whether something isn't a deepfake, if you don't have all that type of surrounding information that we had in the Zelensky case. Mm-hmm. So in the Zelensky case, right, you had a government that was working on behalf of its citizens to warn them. You had the man himself able to come out afterwards. You had, you know, lots of forensic experts who jumped straight in to say, look, we can show what this is. Completely different context here. We have this video released. You can't talk to the man in the video. You can't do these forensic analysis on it. And what we saw in Myanmar was people desperately online trying to work out whether this was a real or a fake video. And the only tools they could find were, you know, online tools, which, you know, claim to show whether something's a deep fake or not. And when they put this video into the those tools, it showed apparently that this was a deep fake, right?
Hmm.
The problem was that the tools we have available now are not very accurate, and they're certainly not very accurate for a deepfake like this, you know, a kind of low resolution video where you don't know how it might have been made, where you're really just sort of applying, you know, the guesswork of an ordinary public person to it. And so you had this rumor spreading in Myanmar that, you know, the government or the military coup had worked out how to deepfake people. They'd done this deepfake of this very prominent politician. And that the likelihood that was subsequently proved true was that this wasn't a deepfake. This was just a video of a man being forced to confess by, you know, under duress. But people's ability to deal with the possibility of it being a deepfake, their ability to assess that, you know, you suddenly moved into this gray area where people are like, you know, we can't work this out. Is this a deepfake or is it not? And increasingly, we've seen similar patterns happening globally where governments will dismiss real videos as deepfakes. So there you had people wanting something to be a deepfake because they didn't want to see this forced confession. In other contexts globally, we've seen more and more of these cases where, you know, governments will dismiss inconvenient videos as deepfakes. And so I think the future looks like more deepfakes, more easily used in a variety of formats like video calls, and also more and more of the ability just to cast real video into doubt.
Yeah, I can see that, you know, apart from the political and diplomatic implications of it, that it could be a big deal in legal context in a courtroom where, you know, we're seeing is believing, right? So video evidence, I mean, like, has been used to convict various people over the past couple of years, as we've seen, and shootings of people out in the street and that kind of thing, that the defendant could just claim, no, that's a deep fake. That's not me. I mean, you know, and as you said, it puts the onus of proof on the accuser instead, you know, and that could be a big thing in the future. You know, basically we're entering like a brave new world. And I guess that brings up the idea of, you know, Big Brother. And so this feeds into authoritarianism, I think, too, because, you know, already many people are easily led and readily believe even the most outlandish conspiracy theories. And so I think that this kind of thing could be used to manipulate them even more easily, don't you? It's another tool for authoritarian dictators to use to control the sheep.
I think it plays into some of the tendencies we've gotten, you know, when we look at one of the strategies for people using deceptive information, and, you know, I'll take the Russia example, you know, that we've seen in Ukraine, but also in other countries of, you know, oftentimes when you're throwing out all these claims of this might be faked, this is fake, you know, and it may or may not, what you're trying to do is muddy the waters. You're trying to say it's impossible to know what's true. And those situations lend themselves best then to people who can exercise real power, right? Like, you know, authoritarians, people who have the ability to say, I know the answer or have the ability to control, you know, power. So I think there's a very deliberate strategy in which deepfakes play a part, which is to sort of undermine people's ability to feel like they know what they can trust, even the evidence of their own eyes. And so, you know, I think this is a very dangerous way in which this plays into some of our existing problems we have with conspiracy theories. It also plays into a little bit like, you know, one of the ways you see people trying to spot deepfakes online. And I gave that example from Myanmar is this, you know, just look at it more closely, try and work out if it's true, right? Dig deeper. And in the Myanmar case, that didn't help people. When they tried to dig deeper, when they stuck it in these online tools, that gave them the wrong results. It led them to, you know, going down the rabbit hole. You know, and so we have to start thinking like our response to deepfake shouldn't be like tell everyone just to scrutinize every pixel of a video. It has to be much more structurally about how do we build better ways in which people can understand whether something was deepfaked, give them better tools for detecting, better tools for authenticating real footage, you know, better government policies, better platform policies that enable us to have a better sense of what is true and false when we encounter these manipulated videos and images.
Apart from governments and so on doing this, how long do you think it will be, and I realize you'd be speculating, until this technology is really freely and readily available to everyone? I mean, when you can make a deep fake video on your smartphone in a few minutes?
I think the answer could be now, right? If you use like, you know, I use a tool called Reface, and folks may have used like Wombo AI. You know, these are tools that allow you to do a very quick deep fake on your phone, usually a kind of celebrity face swap. So in some senses, the tools are available now. The thing about them, and this is a good thing, is that they don't give you like a limitless palette, right? They're not saying you can face swap anyone and you can do it in any circumstance. And it's still quite hard. And I think it's important for folks to know it's still quite hard to do a really convincing like face swap deepfake, right? And then create an entirely new scene and place someone in that. That's not something that is going to happen straight away. That is some years away still, the ability to like create a, you know, a scene out of whole cloth in which there's a complete face swap of, you know, you into a totally compromising novel scene. Mm-hmm. But some things are getting easier. So for example, another form of deepfake technology is the ability to make someone's lips match a different audio track. Right. So sort of what's called lip sync dubbing. And this has lots of good commercial usages, right? So you no longer have to watch a subtitle movie. You can watch a movie that, you know, speaks your language. Those types of deepfake technologies are getting much more accessible. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, different stages over the next few years are going to see different things become more and more available to the public.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, Sam, but do you think social media platforms like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok have a responsibility to moderate this kind of misinformation? And do you think they have the ability to do it? Will they be able to keep up with the technology enough? Even if there's a will there be a way, you know, to drop those things, to tamp it down as much as possible?
So they definitely have a responsibility, you know, particularly when deepfakes are used to target women with those intimate images or to used for disinformation that deceives people and creates harm. And so deepfakes often fall into the same kind of categories we, you know, with varying degrees want them to act on, right? Know that they have a place to prevent harm or to prevent content that really can drive disinformation, hate, or other things on their platforms. The challenge is that they have the same challenge that I was describing in an earlier answer, which is like the detection tools are not yet good enough to apply at internet scale. So we don't want them, for example, to say anything that is deepfaked we should take down because we've got all these fun satires and other things that should be left up. And then the second thing is they won't be able to do it reliably. So we want them to play a role, but we should be aware of the limitations.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky. I mean, all these things just get trickier and trickier as time goes on and technology begins to, we begin to become the tools of technology rather than vice versa as time goes on. And that's where we get into the, again, the quote, brave new world thing. So, you know, final question, I guess, is there an upside to deepfakes? Are there some ways that they can be used as a force for good?
So
is lying ever good?
I think the creativity of deepfakes is good. You know, I love, you know, and there's a satirical deepfakes maker in Brazil who makes these incredible deepfakes of prominent politicians there that make me laugh, make me think about the politics there, you know, make you really understand what's going on in a way that is completely different. So I think deepfakes are a tool for creativity that we should also think, you know, how you can use those responsibly in art, in our own personal entertainment, to share with our friends, you know, for public speech like parody or satire. So, you know, the trick is going to be how do we harness the creativity while, you know, really saying what is not acceptable, right? What is not acceptable, you know, including, you know, making non-consensual sexual images, you know, making images that deceive that you can't spot. So, you know, I'm not someone who believes that all deepfakes are bad. And in fact, often I use the phrase synthetic media, you know, meaning media that's sort of artificially generated, because deepfakes has such a bad connotation for people. They instantly jump to the idea that it's about deceiving people or that it's about, you know, creating these horrible images that attack women.
Well, Sam Gregory, we're going to have to leave it there. You know, I hope that your kind of semi-optimistic assessment at the end is true, but I suspect that the bad will outweigh the good on this, as so often happens with new technologies, and so we're just going to have to take our chances with it. But again, thank you for being on with us, and anyone who wants to find out more about what Sam's organization has been doing and is doing, go to witness.org, just like it's spelled, witness.org. So thanks again to you, Sam, for being on with us.
Thank you, Court. It's great to be here.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.